This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We are on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri with Jose Padua. He's the winner of the Miller Williams Book Award, chosen by Billy Collins. And he'll start by reading a poem. Hey, Jose, what are you going to read us?
I'm going to read this poem called Avenue Banana. Living on Avenue Banana in the 1990s is not a lot like drinking tea. I look up to the sky, you shout at people driving by in limousines. We eat rice and chicken, wonder what to do. You could go home and watch your color TV or whistle on the way to the sink. I can lie back on my mattress like a tiny buffalo and wave my hands at the flies in the air or on my knee. Alone, I see white paint chips on the ceiling, feel the need for something green or golden. With you, there's sometimes a step in between, you sitting in my window reading a magazine. Sometimes we're watching the same movie on different TVs. Other times, I'm giving you cigarettes like moonlight by the sea. And though this isn't Paris in the 1930s, and I can't be Henry Miller and you can't be Anais Nin, the look in your eyes sometimes makes me think of you as Grace Kelly in bed, reading a copy of Vogue, and me as Jimmy Stewart, asleep by the window with two broken legs.
Whoa, that's a relationship poem. Oh. Jose, yes. Why do you believe Billy Collins chose your book?
I think probably what happened is it stood out a bit because, my voice is a little different. I don't come out of academia. I started writing poetry. I did read a lot, however. And I think he figured that also it was a sort of work that Miller Williams himself would have enjoyed, work that wasn't, not necessarily like his own, but, he appreciated Miller Williams. He noted, appreciated all sorts of all varieties of poetry. And I think this is one of those other varieties that he would have enjoyed.
Oh, that's a good answer. So the book is called A Short History of Monsters. The title should have won all by itself. Oh. And can you remember anything Billy Collins actually said about it?
Well, actually, I was surprised when he called me one morning to say that I'd won the prize. And he did, ask me questions about how my... And the poems in that book, like the lines go on so long and sometimes things are kind of jagged and unruly. And I mentioned that I listen to a lot of avant-garde jazz. And and he listens to, he's a very big jazz aficionado himself. Mm-hmm. And so I think that then he said, I think he started to understand like some of my methods and how my own work arranges itself in a way that may not seem coherent at first, but after a while you see there is a method to the madness.
There sure is. And it's out from the University of Arkansas Press right now, and it has found a very prestigious home. This is Billy Collins, former U.S. Poet Laureate, by the way. So just tell us quickly, did you submit it this place for the very first time, or has this been making the rounds and finally found a home, or what happened?
Actually, this is this poem. This is a book. It's my first completed manuscript. Since then, I'd completed about four or five other manuscripts of more recent work, and so book has been circulating in manuscript form for. It had been circulating for about 20 years. It took quite a while to get it out there. But, I had to be patient and, wait for the right opportunity. And I'm glad that I waited.
This is so heartening to people to know that they should never throw it away. Whatever we work on now works for us later. Jose Padua, who is an award-winning poet, and he also won the New Guard Review's 2014 Knightville Poetry Prize. Give us two poems and set them up for us, Jose, so we have a good idea of who you are. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we are on remote.
Okay, this next poem is about when I was, I lived in the Shenandoah Valley with my family for about 10 years, and when I was there, I started writing my blog, and now and then, it being somewhat a less progressive part of the country, I would get nasty comments on my blog, and because I would write on issues of race and that sort of thing. And this poem was inspired by some of the comments I got on a particular posting. This is called Memo in the Form of a Sonnet to the White Supremacist Who Referred to My Wife as a Breeding Vessel for the Hispanic Invasion. Despite my name being Jose, I'm not Hispanic, but Filipino, which means that as far as you're concerned, my white wife is not a breeding vessel for the Hispanic invasion, but for the Asian invasion. Please take note of this. Because the Asian invasion and all the other invasions you fear are gaining strength like tropical depressions, and as the days go by, your vessel will lose more and more of its buoyancy, more of its ability to breed, which means, as far as my wife and I are concerned, that there's still hard work to be done, that, like a sturdy vessel riding high upon the waves, we will continue to float.
Wow. Give us another.
This one is called, And When Lilacs Bloom, There Will Be Enough for Both Anger and Light.
Hmm.
After dinner one evening, my daughter asks, what if I grow up to have anger issues? It feels like a summer night with the warm weather newly arrived, and it's a difficult age and especially hard time to be 9. I remember that age neurotically worrying about every disease I might possibly have, but I never worried about anger issues because back then we rarely used the word issues that way, and I was simply concerned if one day I might go crazy, which was a word back then that covered everything that sent a person to what we called the funny farm, which didn't sound all that bad to me, because at least you got to laugh. And I wondered if more than anything else, that's what made a person crazy, that ability, that tendency, that insurmountable predilection for laughing at the slightest nudge of elbow or brain during even the most solemn and serious occasions. And my answer to my daughter is, no, you won't, because sometimes there are things you need to get angry about, and anger itself is not the issue. Then my daughter, my wife, my son, and I go back in this, the hour of lilacs, to walk upon the grass, the clover, everything that issues forth underneath damp ground in the noble, angry effort to reach the light.
That is such a powerful, another relationship poem, Jose Padua. I want to tell everyone that you have read all over the country, including the New Eureka Poets Cafe, St. Mark's Poetry Project, the Living Theater, the Public Theater in New York. You're really a public poet, and your poems have been in dozens of magazines. So this debut book is so well worth you. Your time and energy. Why did you return to D.C. from Shenandoah Valley?
Oh, well, it was an opportunity that just came about. We weren't expecting it, but our daughter got into the Duke Ellington School here in D.C., and we figured, like, oh, wouldn't be practical if we were, you know, driving her back and forth from Front Royal, Virginia, which is where we were, to D.C., all the time. So we figured that, oh, we can go back to my old family house. My brother still lives in the house where I grew up when I was a child, and so
wow.
Me and my family, we moved back into our old neighborhood, and our daughter was able to attend Ellington, and you know, we were DC residents again, so that really worked out. And we were looking for a way to get back to town, because you know, also my wife had a terribly long commute every day to work because she still worked closer to town, and so it really just fortunate how things worked out that our daughter's opportunities turned out to be an opportunity for us as well.
What a wonderful father to move physically and geographically to give his daughter a vocation in the arts. And your wife is a poet as well.
Yes.
Let us, Heather Davis, that's her name.
Yeah.
Well, did you find writing in Shenandoah was different from writing in an urban area?
Actually, I found myself incredibly inspired by being out there, mostly because of how much more difficult it was for us socially. Like out there, you know, it took work to find the people that we could connect with, and but once we found that we made really great friends out there, and that there are really great people out there. It's not all insanely conservative folks out there, but you do have to look that look out look for them.
I know. I lived in West Virginia.
Oh.
But there were some great folks, yes. Let us hear another poem. Jose Padua, winner of the Miller Williams Poetry Prize from the University of Arkansas Press.
This is another poem about living in small-town America there in Front Royal, Virginia. This is called The Sight of My Neighbor Limping. The sight of my neighbor limping to his front door in the dim late evening light, walking towards, rocking from his truck, down the driveway to the sidewalk, then toward the front steps of his house, his bad arm nearly dragging from his shoulder behind his back like some name he can't remember, an old friend from back in the day when he lived closer to the city with plenty to do and places to go, reminds me of how little I know of his story. Just that his wife has a hard time staying sober long enough so the cops don't have to drag her away to jail. Just an idea that when the liquor has left the blood that flows beneath one's skin, the cold gray walls of a jail cell must look like the hardest substance on earth.
Mm.
Which is to say that it's so much easier for me to imagine being her than being him, so much easier to think about things done wrong than things lost. And he takes his good arm and stretches it straight in front of him as he turns to pull his front door shut in time to sit in front of the television to watch the Sunday night game. His wife is coming home again at the end of the month, when it'll be more than halfway through the third quarter season's rush toward winter. Time to crank up the wood stove, send rough blue smoke from the chimney toward the sky. Time to feel the tips of all one's fingers, celebrate the motions that make it easy to believe it's easy being alive. Comfort is the warmth and stillness of sitting near the heart of a 100-year-old small-town house. Comfort is the moment after work when there's nothing that needs to be moved.
There is such power in that narrative, and it's such a strong story. But what I like about your writing is that you have a velvet glove on a fist. You talk about very strong things, but your word choices are really very favorable to listen to, so that your diction doesn't make the reader want to run away. In other words, you can talk about an unpleasant situation in a poem, but you can make it surrounded by an ability to be gently persuasive. So there's nothing harsh or abrasive in your writing. Are you aware of that, or has anyone ever told you that?
Oh, people have told me that, you know, I do hear it quite a lot, that they don't peep from people who say they don't usually go for poetry, but my poetry somehow, for some reason, they enjoy. And although early on when I was, you know, first started reading, I did try to be more, take a more confrontational approach to doing a reading, like I was trying to be a bit of a performer, and such I would say, when I was on stage, I didn't want to be loved. That was the attitude I had in as a reader. I just wanted to try to upset people, confront people. But of course now I don't mind being loved.
Ah, oh, I don't either. Let's have a couple more poems. Jose Padua, I don't mind being loved. I'll remember that about you. Let us have a couple more poems.
Okay, here's this is like a love poem. This is called Still Life with Uranus in the Chapel of Love. Be still like a knife on the table after late dinner with rice and lamb and grapes. The curtains are not yet drawn over the breezy spring windows, and lamplight from the street illuminates dimly the faint yellow of the stucco walls. Listen, the star tango's accordion vibrates through blue smoke. We breathe in the smoke and sound until our lungs hurt, until when the storm covers the city center with rain and electricity, and our arms tighten as if stuck, and our backs bend as if breaking, and our mouths are pried open with indelicacy, and the neighbors pound on the walls with their hands as we sing.
Jose Padua, and he has returned to Washington after living in the Shenandoah Valley, and is 4 manuscripts waiting. Do you think the University of Arkansas will take another?
Oh, I don't know. I would have to check with them. I wonder if they'd be interested.
Well, if you don't, you're missing an opportunity because they are publishing your book, and they have published it. I would go back with another as soon as possible.
Oh, well, I'll have to do that.
Look how modest you are. You never thought of it. But let us have a poem to see if we can love you or not.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress in uno senso, but not in it materially. Okay, Jose, let's hear it.
Well, here's a poem that actually mentions Arkansas. This is called Love is Like Arkansas.
Mm.
Love is like Arkansas, a little bit backwards sometimes. The best days are slow, simple, like white rice and black beans on a paper plate for lunch. The worst are when you can't understand what the other is saying. A seed from a southern cypress fallen too far from the stream. A woman in a beige dress too sure of herself, yelling at a woman in a white dress, less sure, but standing tall and walking on. It's the certainty that ails us. The thing we know when we don't. The river that runs away from us to the north, where it's cold and dark and muddy. Love is the loving of the doubt of what's wrong as much as what's right. That wrinkle, that gray, that blemish that mellows, even blossoms in the soft early evening light.
Jose Padua spends a lot of his time looking at people and observing people. And that is what is different about the poet. The poet notices everything. The woman in the beige dress, the woman in the white dress. And then you sprinkle it with philosophical observations, which is, I think, a good way to characterize your work. So let's hear another one and see if I'm right.
This one is called, this is another relationship poem. I guess you could say this is called A Song for Sunshine. This evening when I got home from the store, I laid a bag down on the kitchen table and said to my wife and daughter, check this out. My wife opened the bag, pulled out what was inside and said, oh, they're apples, and I smiled. But they're not just any apples, I explained, and I paused so as to make my great surprise even greater. This is a technique I learned on the city streets. Pause if you want to surprise the hell out of anyone. Then I said it. They're not just apples, they're jazz apples, and I pointed to the tiny purple sticker attached to the red and yellow surface of one of the apples. See, it says jazz, because they're not regular apples, they're jazz apples, I said, and I nodded the way I do when I'm driving home a point and swept up my hand toward the ceiling the way I do when I'm blown away by the marvels of the world we live in. My wife looked at me, then my daughter looked at me, and my daughter asked, yes, but are they organic? And I paused again, a technique I learned to use in school whenever I had an answer that I knew wasn't the right answer. Then said, no, and repeated again because I am a poet who on occasion repeats the word, a phrase, a line for the beautiful music it creates. They're not regular apples, they're jazz apples. Then my wife said, we can't eat those. Apples are the worst for retaining pesticides. And without missing a beat, without taking the time to breathe, much less pause, a method I learned on my own, because as a poet, I'm the inventor of marvelous things people don't know need to be invented, I said, the best jazz is always a little dangerous. And my point was driven home to my wife and daughter, and one day my son, who is still too young to understand, will indeed understand this, and what a great pleasure it is to live with me.
Wow. The sticker on an apple brings forth a 30-line poem. A sticker on an apple inspires the poet to talk about jazz, his philosophy of life, his family, and it all started with that little apple you brought home from the store.
Yes.
Isn't it wonderful to live this way, though?
Oh, yeah. That's, you're being a poet, you know, it just brings so many, you know, it just makes every moment, I think, you know, that much richer. You let your mind make all these different connections, which maybe aren't, quote unquote, useful or not the connections that won't pay the rent. But it just makes life so much better that you can make these connections and that have these ideas floating around in all these varied ways. I couldn't imagine living my life any other way.
I agree. It's like being awake, isn't it?
Yes.
And looking at a window that is not a dirty window. You're looking through a clear window all the time.
Oh.
And I just find that it doesn't, as you say, pay the rent. But what a way to live. What a way to live. Jose has won a prize for A Short History of Monsters. I hope everyone will go look for that. It's on the shelf now, right?
Yes.
Oh, good. And did you like the cover that was chosen?
Oh, I thought the artist, Bruce New, I think is he in Arkansas too? But I thought what he did for the cover was just amazing.
Oh, that is so good to hear. And Jose, let's have another poem.
Okay, let's see. This is called Words and Letters. When I was in first grade, I hated the box of little cardboard squares with the letters printed on them, because whenever they took it out and put it on the desk in front of me, I knew it meant they wanted me to take the letters and make words, and I hated making words with letters. Why, I wondered, would they not just let me speak? That box is long gone, and the letters in it decayed, disintegrated, dissolved into dust. And now, decades later, I am a grown man who cannot be told to make words, which means that in writing a poem, I'm fulfilling neither duty nor obligation, but rather am committing my daily act of revenge.
But don't you think as a child that language spoke to you?
Oh yes. But with this, they wouldn't have known back then, but I'm attention deaf, ADD and OCD and all these other isms. And back then, like when you put a box of letters in front of me, it was just this wild jumble of objects that I couldn't make sense of. And so I just wanted to speak and not have to create letters to take these letters and make language that way. And of course, now the odd thing is that this is what I love to do, take these letters and get my daily revenge with my language.
Yes, but sound from the beginning was important to you.
Oh, yes.
And music is important to you.
Certainly.
So do you speak more than one language?
No, I actually only speak language. Well, English, although my parents came here from the Philippines, like I was probably like a lot of other immigrant children who wanted to just fit in. And so I was thinking, oh, I just want to be like an American and blend in. But not until later did I learn to appreciate the Philippine language, Tagalog, and I wished I had learned it, because now I would have that I would be able to communicate with, you know, distant relatives and that sort of thing.
I agree entirely. I myself was not allowed to learn Italian at home. We were being mainstream, weren't we?
Yes.
But we survived, and our revenge is daily writing. And I know you write a poem every day, so we're willing to hear another.
Oh, I do have a poem about writing a poem every day. Let me find that. A poem every day. To write a poem every day is a frightening thing to do. Lives are ruined. Sadness fills the heart, and time moves at an unbearable pace when it's not done right. To choose between the words crinoline and obfuscate always leaves someone's feelings hurt and another person annoyed, and here and there, a man wearing glasses and a hat, or a woman with her hair in a bun, enraged by my diction. With all the evil already in the world, why must I add to it? Can I not sit still and listen to the news? Can't I just take a day to separate image from word and leave these ugly pink flowers unnamed?
Love that last line. Yeah, the poet can't leave anything alone. That's our problem. We mess everything up and make it better in the messing. And tell me just shortly, what your next book that you want to get published is about. Is it like this first book? Do you find it different in form, craft, or theme?
Well, the next book that I've been trying to, at least the ones that chronologically that comes right after this current book, take a lot of the poems that I had started writing when I was when we moved out to the Shenandoah Valley. After finishing the work on the first book, I somehow I found like I quit smoking. I couldn't write much, and it took me a while to start writing again. It was in when we moved to the Shenandoah Valley that I was able to write again, and I started writing about more about nature and more about people and family and relationships. Whereas in my earlier poems, I was writing a lot about being a bit of a beast and being out and crazy. So it is a bit of a shift from being a young hellion to being an older family man.
What is the title of the new manuscript?
That first manuscript, it's called, the name of this book is Swan Lake. And it's...
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it takes off of a song by the group Blackalicious, and it involves your usual weird connections from one thing to another.
Just like jazz.
Yes.
Let us have a final poem.
This one is called... When I Was a Kiss, and this is from that second manuscript. When I was a kiss and the world was an elephant, I didn't want to touch because if it didn't like me, it might crush me. I'd bend over forwards or backwards and twist as if I were dancing, but I wasn't dancing. I was stepping away from the flames and jumping over sinkholes that opened in the street, or just listening to side B of a 45 before side A, because one way to do battle when I was young was to know what other people didn't know was right under their noses. Sometimes that meant knowing something they'd never know, which was sort of like tying the elephant's trunk in a knot and laughing, then walking away until the elephant starts to miss you. When I lived in the city, usurped by the old sheen of a road that's been stepped upon too many times, I still knew which way to go, and I went there to follow only you.
The voice of Jose Padua, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.